Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deteriorating situation in the dangerously polarized country of Venezuela, where President Maduro is cracking down on student demonstrations while blaming the U.S. for conspiring against his government. Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian, joins us to discuss the arrest of an opposition leader who led demonstrations and the government's apparent inability to deal with or take responsibility for an economy with 56% inflation, shortages of food and basics like toilet paper, and security for citizenry facing the worst crime and murder rate in the world. Then we'll look into overpaid CEOs, the president's modest proposal in the recent State of the Union for a MIRA, or My IRA, and remarks by former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers calling for changes in the tax code that allows a far greater share of the income of the rich to escape taxation than the poor and middle class. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss his article at the UK Guardian, True Free Market Proponents Should Support Private-Public Competition, and his article at the Huffington Post, Corporate Cronyism, the Secret to Overpaid CEOs. Then finally, we'll speak with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and political media consultant who has a new ebook, The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved, and an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. We will discuss his call to action for victims of the $1.1 trillion student debt crisis and his plan to rescue an indentured generation that is fair to both bankers and borrowers alike. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, who is a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, how are you?
And every time I call you, Virginia, it's always bad news. And apparently the news is getting worse now in Venezuela. The polarization that's been going on now for over a decade has reached a point where massive demonstrations, the students are demonstrating. Apparently, there have been a number of people shot, and now an opposition leader is being hunted down by the government, and he's being accused of fomenting social unrest, and the government's just kicked out three U.S. consular officials that they blame for all of this unrest. At what point does Maduro take responsibility for anything that's happening in his country?
I'll just start by telling you that the opposition leader that was being hunted down has been just held by authorities about an hour or so ago. He was heading a protest of peaceful demonstrators and basically handed himself in in a very strong statement saying that he was innocent and also, ratifying that this was a peaceful protest and that by handing himself in, he wanted to show that he had nothing to fear, he had done nothing illegal, and again, ratifying a message of peace to his followers. When does Maduro take responsibility? Maduro gave a very strong statement on Sunday calling Lopez a fascist and comparing Lopez's actions or his calling of peaceful protest to Nazi Germany, but after that he's not been seen. He's supposed to be giving a nationwide address in the following hours, but. I've yet to hear what he's going to say in reaction to this recent jailing or imprisonment of Lopez. Up till now, the government's reaction has been to decry all of these student protests as acts of fascism and also to say that they are backed by the U.S. It doesn't seem like there's too much of a dialogue in the next, couple of hours or even in the near future. It's a polarized situation, like you said.
But isn't the economy driving a lot of the popular anger, the lack of civil protection from crime, this is a country with a population equal to Canada
that has a murder rate greater than the United States. I mean, has the highest murder rate in the world, my understanding is. And basic things like toilet paper you can't get. You've got 56% inflation. I mean, is anybody in the government talking about the real problems that the Venezuelan people have? I can't imagine the U.S., you know, they had a hand in that original coup against Chavez, I think, in 92, that was like the most incompetent coup attempt in history. I cannot for the life of me imagine that the U.S. is trying to do anything except stay out of the way, because this sounds like a problem between Venezuelans.
I couldn't be more in agreement. It seems to me that this government is facing real challenges and real questions to its ability to govern. Venezuela has also been undergoing one of its highest, oil prices have been at a record high for the last at least 12 years, and nobody really knows what's been done with that money or even where it is. It's not just food shortages. It's having to, stand in line for hours on end. It's food rationing. It's a soaring crime rate. All this with the backdrop of having gone through one of the biggest oil booms in our country's history. So, this government is facing serious challenges, you know, to its ability to govern. Those are not addressed. It's one of the things that I kept on hearing today as I covered the march from people that attended. And surprisingly, I actually interviewed several people that were not even going to participate in the march because they weren't totally in agreement with it, but that still, coincided that this has gone on for too long and that there's no end in sight and that they're desperate. They're reaching a point of sort of critical mass. It's a bit of the general sentiment that I got today.
And again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the UK and Sky TV. And my understanding is that, first of all that oil money was spent, but worse than that, the oil that's in the ground has been mortgaged to the Chinese, who have been keeping this government going. You know, a lot of Chavez's cronies and family have made an enormous amount of wealth. The cronyism, to my mind, every time I do an interview with somebody like you in Venezuela who's actually describing the situation the way it is and trying to be objective, American leftists get hysterical because they're so invested in this romantic idea of revolution. And to my mind, it doesn't do anybody any good when a socialist revolution goes off the rails. It doesn't do socialism any good.
Certainly not. I agree. I think that, this is probably going to go down as a huge embarrassment to socialism. Hospitals have collapsed. The educational system is in shambles. Infrastructure is crumbling. This isn't just a matter of food shortages, which are, of course, quite serious. This is basically a country that's spiraling out of control. Like I said, the murder rate here is a huge concern. The victims of this murder rate are not, wealthy Venezuelans. It's primarily young men living in shanty towns being killed by peers. So it's the young against the young, undereducated, probably, I don't know, there's huge problems of drug dealing going on, but that's a rumor that keeps on being heard. Increasingly so, and the corruption's just mounting to the point where even government officials admit to it. There's also been price controls that have done nothing but create all sorts of distortions, currency controls that again have only led to more and more corruption. There's been some acknowledgement of that by Maduro, but really, other than an acknowledgement, absolutely no sign that these people will in any way be prosecuted for this crime. So, I was speaking to a woman at today's protest, and she was saying that one of the reasons that she had so vehemently gone to protest, regardless of the repression that we've seen in the last couple of days, was because she was outraged that the police could be so efficient at repressing protests, but so inefficient at controlling crime. So again, just to tell you that there's mounting indignation at the way that this has all been handled.
But Virginia Lopez, why is Leopoldo Lopez the leader of this small party called Popular Will? Why is he being singled out as such a threat to the government? I mean, these protests were largely started by students. I don't understand what their case is and why they're trying to pin it both on the Americans and on this guy.
Well, my first reaction is that it's probably a smokescreen. It's one that nobody really knows what effect it's going to have. It could backfire. It could be that they've just created, you know, the next leader of the opposition, or it could be that, you know, that this just sort of evaporates into nothingness. There's a lot of people that have been jailed by the government and that are still waiting to be tried. Lopez had been quite vocal in asking Venezuelans to take to the streets to protest. He'd been saying that, you know, that the street was the way out. He was sort of heading a campaign called La Salida, which is Spanish for the exit. And in the last couple of months, he'd been quite vocal in his disapproval of the way that Venezuela is being governed. He's accused the government of being involved in narco-trafficking, of being a kleptocracy, of being incredibly corrupt. So again, he's just probably he's become the most vocal critic in these last couple of months. He counts with the support of the opposition coalition, but several of the leaders have also sort of vehemently asked for protests to be peaceful and have said that, you know, that a violent takeover isn't really the way for change here.
Well, but the fact that he's taken to the streets, isn't that in large part because there is no way to express political opposition in Venezuela? Because the media now is completely controlled by the government, except for some newspapers, but the main media, the television and radio, isn't that totally dominated by Maduro and the Chavistas?
Well, the incidents of the last couple of days, which I think have worked to bring out a lot of the sort of the latent problems that certainly the world isn't seeing in Venezuela, have also shown the extent to which there's a media blackout here in Venezuela. You're right, most of the TV stations are now under government control, be it overtly or, you know, or have been bought by pro-government, the private channels like Globovisión have been bought by, you know, businessmen with close ties to the government. We've been going through a media blackout, not only with the local media, but also with Colombian news channel NTN 24, NTN 24, being taken off the air and even off of the cable stations. Also, Twitter made a public statement saying that the signal here in Venezuela was being blocked. So yes, it's been incredibly difficult to know exactly what's going on. You know, people are taking massively to Twitter to inform, which of course also leads to a series of, you know, confusions and misinformation. So all very difficult, but also an incredibly dramatic way of showing how so many institutions in this country have been taken over by the government. And I'm not only referring to the media. It is one of Lopez's points is that, you know, the powers here have been sequestered. You know, there isn't a reliable judicial system. Even you know, everything's highly politicized. So yes, I think that he was trying to bring this to the forefront.
And the Colombian news channel, were they objective or were they, you know, anti-Maduro in their reporting?
It's they were probably anti-Maduro in their reporting, but the truth is that what was going on wasn't necessarily being shown in other TV stations at all. So, it's just a really difficult situation to gauge. Having said that, however, reporters of a newspaper called Últimas Noticias, which was sold to a pro-government group just recently, also wrote an open letter to the public denouncing that the front page that they had designed and were ready to run was changed at the last minute to give the whole news a different twist. They've also been incredibly active in piecing together all sorts of amateur and professional video of the way that two people were killed during the protest, two of armed security bodies from the government, which, according to the Venezuelan Constitution, should not be armed during a protest and certainly not shooting at people. But again, this has only been seen through social media.
Right.
They managed to publish it in their newspaper as well, I should say.
So the two victims were anti-government protesters. They were killed by pro-regime thugs. Is that what you're telling us?
There's three people that were killed, and a fourth one was run over yesterday. The three people, it was one student protesting against Chavez and then a member of a colectivo, which is a sort of armed militia-like group, pro-government. The circumstances have yet to be determined, but Maduro did say that these two men were killed by the same gun. In a separate incident that same night, another young man was killed as he protested, as the protest sort of escalated a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, there's been no official statement as to who killed these. From the video that these journalists put together, a lot of shots were fired by men that seemed to be with a group of government security forces.
So what is the Maduro? Obviously, he's not addressing the underlying problems of 56% inflation, the highest crime rate in the world, lack of basic staples like food and toilet paper. But apparently he is organizing the oil workers to come out in terms of counter demonstrations. He obviously doesn't have the same charismatic appeal that Chavez has. Are his supporters starting to lose their steam? I mean, they're all living in the same country. How long can you live on slogans?
There's a part of me that wants to say that if you're having to recruit government workers to march, that must certainly signal that you don't count with too much support. No, at least not the sort of spontaneous mass rallies that Chavez was able to amass on short notice. But ironically, the truth is that in the municipal elections of December, he won, or his party won by quite a bit considerable support. So, it's a difficult situation. There were municipal elections. There's not necessarily a huge voter turnout in municipal elections. But I think, I think the general sense in Venezuela is that this is difficult to tolerate for much longer, is what I kept on hearing today in the street. Like I said, from people on both spectrums of the political divide. The other thing that has happened, I think, is that, again, most people are moderate, but in the last couple of days, we've only been hearing the more sort of radical voices of both camps, no?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, that's likely to continue as long as you have polarization, and the people in the middle, are they being listened to?
No, not really. There isn't too much space for dialogue. And like I said, in these last events have only made this the very small or reduced spaces for dialogue have been reduced even further. These events have only escalated the feeling of desperation in the country.
Well, Virginia Lopez, we'll stay in touch. I hope that next time I call you, we can talk about something better than the bad news that you've given us here today. But it does sound like a country spiraling out of control?
I think you might be calling me in a couple of hours.
Okay. Thank you for joining us.
Likewise. Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Larry Summers' remarks about increasing taxes on the 1%. Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, The Recovery from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article in the UK Guardian, True Free Market Proponents Should Support Private-Public Competition, and another at the Huffington Post, Corporate Cronyism, The Secret to Overpaid CEOs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And the great bête noire to many liberals, and particularly liberal economists, of course, is Larry Summers. And he's come out suggesting not so much that people like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates should pay more income tax, but that we should close tax loopholes that largely benefit the richest 1%, like capital gains exemptions, real estate provisions, and corporate tax breaks. And this would help the middle class. So in terms of corporate cronyism, the secrets to overpaid CEOs, that's all we've been hearing lately, hasn't it? Billionaires talking about Kristallnacht and being oppressed and the 1% being scapegoated, and even saying that the super rich should, depending on how many millions they have, they should get more votes per millions of dollars. I mean...
Yeah. No, it's good to see Larry Summers. I think he said similar things in the past. They'd support higher taxes, getting rid of some of the loopholes. You know, I think that's a good idea, how far you can go with that. For example, capital gains is a little tricky because people won't declare capital gains. In other words, you know, if I have a ton of stock and, you know, it doubles, triples, quadruples, as it is, you only pay tax when you actually sell it. So you have an very easy way to avoid capital gains taxes. You just don't sell it. So, you know, again, I'm all for cutting loopholes, closing loopholes. I just don't know how far that goes. What I focused on in talking about CEOs in much of my work is how these people got so rich to begin with. And there I took really strong issue with Larry Summers, because I think he gives them a buy. And he says, you know, look, we really can't keep them from getting rich. And the point I've made, and, you know, certainly in talking about the CEOs, they get rich because we made a structure that gets them rich, and we can keep them from getting that rich. And in that piece, I was focusing on directors. These are the people who are supposed to be looking at the CEO and saying, are you doing us shareholders the best job possible for the money we pay you? Can we get someone else at a lower price? Can we go to Europe? Can we go to China and get someone at a lower price? And I say that to people, invariably they laugh. And I go, no, that is what the directors are supposed to be doing. But they never do it. I'm sure they would all laugh if I suggested it to them.
Well, my understanding is that so much of corporate America now, the CEOs are buying back stock, even Apple, which is a very popular and user-friendly corporation, buying back their stock. But isn't the CEO class, aren't they the servants to the banks and the oligarchs? And that they're essentially operating, isn't this kind of a bribe that if you do our bidding, you can make hundreds of millions of dollars?
Well, that's very hard to put it that way because you have a lot of people who run companies to make hundreds of millions of dollars and wreck them. You know, so you had the CEO at AIG who walked away with a going-away price of $40 million. Now, was he doing what someone was asking him to do when he almost would have put him out of business absent a government bailout? I think he was just very happy to pocket $40 million, and he was ripping off the shareholders. Now, in general, I'm not going to like the shareholders per se, but among the shareholders are government pension funds, private pension funds, and a lot of individuals with 401ks. And, you know, given the choice of the money going to the CEOs or the shareholders, I would say the shareholders because, you know, they're at least putting up the money. The CEOs are just ripping off the company.
Well, one of the cases that I've always referred to because of the issues involving broadband, and you know that since that Verizon case in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that could destroy net neutrality, the CEO of Verizon, which is the company, by the way, that won the suit against the interests of the consumers, and now you've had Comcast and Time Warner merging. So in trying to cover that, the former CEO of Verizon's the guy that put down Fios, which was a great high-speed fiber optic system, but Wall Street decided it was too long-term and they wanted short-term profit results, so they forced him out and they got a compliant CEO. So that's my paradigm, if you will, for how I see corporate America operating. But
I see corporate America operating increased profits. And my point here is that you have a lot of CEOs, they don't increase the company's profits. They don't increase the share price, and they still put tens of millions, hundreds of millions in their pocket. I take it for granted. Companies are going to try and make profit, you know, which means they're going to do a lot of sleazy thing. That raises another issue. But companies are going to try and make profits. I just take that for granted. That means paying workers as little possible. It means if they could increase monopoly power in the market, they're going to do that. They don't have to pay CEOs tens of millions or hundred millions to do that because they have plenty who will do it for $1 million, $2 million. So you know, if they're doing something horrible, I would rather them pay a CEO $1 or $2 million rather than $40 million. And part of the point here is, again, that's money from shareholders, but this also creates a pay structure throughout the economy. You have university presidents that get $2 million a year. And their assistants who are twiddling their thumbs, you know, the deans, the provost, they can get hundreds of thousands. They get $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, some of these people. So you create a pay structure throughout the economy that's really pernicious as a result of having these hugely overpaid CEOs. So it's not to defend at all the pernicious things that many companies do to maximize profits. But I take it for granted they're going to do that. They don't have to pay someone $40 million to do that. There's plenty of people willing to do that for $1 million, $1.5 million.
So how then do they get away with it, Dean Baker? How do they value themselves in this way? I mean, here in Hollywood, big movie stars that launch movies get paid a lot of money, less than they used to, you know, the George Clooney's and the Brad Pitts. But that's based upon their popularity at the end of the day. In the corporate system that you have here in the United States, it would be like paying Chuck Norris $20 million for a film.
Yeah, this is what we're trying to highlight. You know, we started this feature on our website, Director Watch, and we're partnering with Huffington Post that has PayPal's, which is the database for this. The story, the people who are supposed to hold down CEO pay are the corporate directors. They're supposed to work for the shareholders, and they're supposed to be constantly saying to the CEO, are you doing the best job that we could, you know, that any CEO could do for us? Are you doing it at the least possible cost? And again, I really doubt they ever ask that question. I really doubt they ever say, oh, can we get someone for less? And they routinely sign contracts with CEOs that just make no sense. The CEO of Exxon back a few years ago walked away with somewhere around $400 million. Wasn't he done a great job running the company? Oil prices went through the roof while he was CEO, so Exxon's profits and stock prices did. Now, did they have to write a contract that allowed him to get hugely rich because of something he had nothing to do with? They could have just indexed his pay to the share prices of other oil companies, and I doubt he would have walked away with a tenth as much. They aren't stupid people. They know how to do that. So the point here is to put pressure on the directors. They're supposed to be working for the shareholders, and what that means is not paying the CEO $1 more than you have to.
Again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. He has an article at the UK Guardian, True Free Market Proponents Should Support Private-Public Competition, and another at the Huffington Post, Corporate Cronyism, The Secret to Overpaid CEOs. Now, turning to your article in the UK Guardian, you're talking about Obama's mention in his State of the Union of MIRA, My IRA, or MIRA, yeah, as it's called. Is that... most of his proposals were pretty modest, in terms of paying government contract workers minimum wage. I didn't get the impression that the big issues were being taken on. In contrast to President Obama, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are proposing, to save the post office, which is going broke. Most coverage about it is it's going broke because of FedEx and UPS. But the main reason it's going broke is that they have to prepay 75 years of pensions, billions and billions of dollars in the red, by a decree from the Congress. But in order to save the post office, as opposed to Dianne Feinstein's husband, who's been given an exclusive contract to sell off these valuable properties in a huge windfall for him and his company, what Senators Warren and Sanders are suggesting is that the post office could start banking, which they used to do in the 60s.
No, it's exactly right. And, in fact, the Postal Service, the head of the Postal Service has suggested this himself. So it's not just, a few members in Congress, a few progressives. It's, it's coming from the Postal Service as well. And the argument here is that you have a great resource. You have post offices, basically in every neighborhood in the country. And why not take advantage of these resources? Why not use them to offer an alternative to the private financial system that, you have large unbanked population, a lot of people aren't being served or well served. So why not give them the option of banking with the Postal Service if they would like? And I think it's a great idea. And again, it's really hard to see a downside. And, we aren't talking about outlawing private banking, so it's not as though we're going to be shutting down the private banks. We're going to be giving people an option. And if they don't think the post office is a good alternative, they don't think it's efficient, they're not friendly or whatever, go with the private banking system. But, here we're just talking about giving people an option. And it's just striking how much anger that provokes.
Well, isn't there something like 60 million Americans that don't have bank accounts that would if they could, and that they rely on payday lenders and people like that? And most of them are in these rural areas where the post office or the postal service serves these areas.
Dude, I'm not positive it's as high as 60 million, but we have somewhere around 15% to 20% of the households are unbanked. And, they certainly could benefit from having access to banking services. And, on the one hand, you have the payday lenders. The other that's probably at least as pernicious is these money order places, where certainly this is true for the immigrant population. But a lot of people, when they want to, they have to have a check made out, they go down and they could pay $5, $10 on a check that might be $50, $60, $100, incredibly high percentage payment. So it might not be that high as a dollar amount. You look at it at $5 or $10, but in terms of the amount of money, a share of the amount of money, it's enormous. So if you had a postal banking system where people can go down there and have a money order made out, whatever it costs, a dollar, $2, that would certainly be an enormous savings for this unbanked population, which is generally lower-income people.
So, Dean Baker, just returning to Larry Summers, the kind of bête noir of liberals, who was President Obama's economic advisor and Treasury Secretary, he has this op-ed in the Washington Post on Sunday that argued that taxing the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Bill Gates is not going to help the middle class, but closing tax loopholes that benefit the wealthy, like the capital gains exemptions and real estate provisions and corporate tax breaks, this could help the middle class and poor Americans. And this, of course, in the context of how many of the one percenters are getting defensive and paranoid and strange, like this Tom Perkins guy talking about Kristallnacht and we should have more, if we have more money, we should have more votes, that kind of insanity. Do you think that Summers is going to he's going to move this debate? Because it's out there in the zeitgeist, isn't it, in terms of people's growing awareness of the income and wealth inequality in this country?
Well, it's helpful for obviously Summers has a lot of prominence and, again, someone who tends to be on the more conservative, but certainly corporate side of things. So it's certainly good to have him out there. But I think, as I say, I think the more important thing is to focus on the before-tax income, how it is that these people got so rich to begin with. I know when I wrote about this, he mentioned Bill Gates, and I thought one of the great ironies, well, why is Bill Gates very rich? Well, not because he's created great software. I don't know anyone. I'm more at the user end, but I know people who are at the producer end of software. I don't know anyone who thinks that Microsoft is a good operating system. He managed to monopolize the industry because he has very sharp elbows, and basically he ignored the rules from the Justice Department, let him do that. So my view is, well, no, actually, there are things we could do that would have made Bill Gates much less wealthy. It might be too late now because his monopoly is already fading. But, if you go back 10, 15, 20 years, we could have made him less wealthy by preventing him from monopolizing the market and had better software. So Summer's piece, he was warning, oh, you don't want to do that because then, we wouldn't have the incentives for people like Bill Gates to become very wealthy. I look at it and go, well, no, the way Bill Gates got wealthy was by basically giving us bad software and using his, again, smart guy, I'm sure, his ingenuity, whatever, to monopolize the market, not by giving us the best possible software. So I want to look at the ways in which these people have gotten extremely rich and change the rules so that they don't facilitate these huge fortunes, often in ways that hurt the economy.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Guardian at the UK Guardian, True Free Markets Proponents Should Support Private-Public Competition, and another at the Huffington Post, Corporate Cronyism, The Secrets to Overpaid CEOs. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with Bill Zimmerman talking about his new e-book, The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for weather, each of them bigger than our manhood together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and candidate races that elected Senator Tim Worth, Senator Gary Hart, and Governor Tony Anaya. In 1990, he co-founded the political consulting and advertising firm Zimmerman & Markman, Incorporated, and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. His latest book is The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Zimmerman.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
And the student loan crisis is, as you point out in your Huffington Post piece, has all the earmarks of a repeat of the 2008 subprime housing crisis, with $1.1 trillion in unsecured educational debt, much of which will not be repaid. I've been covering for some time the more egregious and obvious part of this bigger problem, and that is the for-profit college racket, where the government gives $33 billion a year to basically a bunch of crooks who rip off students. But you're talking about a bigger picture. So paint the bigger picture, if you will, Bill.
Well, as you pointed out, there's over $1 trillion in unsecured debt, and that creates a danger to the entire economy, similar to the danger that housing debt created in 2008. We also have 40 million Americans who owe that money. Now, some of those 40 million are able to pay. They have decent jobs and can make the loan payments that are required. But many of them are recent graduates, younger people, who've had a very hard time finding employment in this economy, especially after 2008. And they are stuck with loan payments that are required of them every month, fixed amounts, and they can't afford them. That's led to 6 million defaults so far, and about 12 to 15 million people who are chronically delinquent in making these payments. One of the problems for them is that Congress has made it illegal to discharge student loan debt through bankruptcy. So even if they are unemployed, have no resources, and no real prospects for the future, and are suffering under a mountain of debt which prevents them from participating in the economy, they can't get out from under that debt because that debt cannot be discharged. In 1998, Congress made it illegal to discharge federal student loans through bankruptcy, and more outrageously, in 2005, they made it illegal to discharge a private debt between a student and a bank through bankruptcy. So the government's created a situation where it's impossible for students who are unemployed or underemployed to make their payments. How many students fit that category? Well, in 2012, a think tank at Northeastern University estimated that more than half of the previous year's national graduating class, that is, the class that graduated in June 2012, more than half of them were unemployed or underemployed, meaning that they either didn't have jobs, were working in unpaid internships, or were flipping hamburgers with bachelor's degrees or doing other menial work far less than what they expected when they graduated. So we've created a situation where the cost of education has been shifted from the state to the student. The state used to pay for public colleges and community colleges. Now those institutions have very high tuition that makes them inaccessible to working class kids. So students have to borrow $20,000 to $40,000 a year to attend college. That never used to be true. When they get out, they land in an economy which cannot provide for all of them the kinds of jobs that they need to pay off those debts, and they can't discharge the debts through bankruptcy. So in effect, they're in a debtor's prison without walls, and they are prevented from participating in the economy. What does that mean? It means that if they don't have credit ratings, they can't rent apartments. Many of those people are living in their parents' basements for that reason. Without credit rating, they can't start businesses. They can't buy automobiles. They can't purchase homes. Many of these people are forestalling first marriages or forestalling having children because of this economic constraint. So we are damning a good portion of an entire generation to this kind of economic hardship, all because the banks are taking an enormous amount of money out of this system and keeping it for profit. In my book, I have calculated that the banks have probably made something on the order of $800 billion in profits from student loans over the past several decades. That amount of money has got to have played a role in the current income and wealth inequality that's also inhibiting the larger American economy. So we have a crisis here that starts with student loans, but has tentacles that reach out to many other sectors of the economy and many other issues.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. He's the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s, and his latest book is The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. So the Higher Education Act of 1965 essentially started us on this road. It created a risk-free business for banks, but then it essentially, you know, the government as the people's advocate, if you will, relinquished that role and became boosters for the banks. And now we're at a situation where in your new e-book, The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved, you're essentially giving this book away. It's on Amazon and other places for 99 cents. The purpose, I imagine, being that students are broke, they can't afford it. You're trying to organize a whole student movement in terms of a dissident movement, or in fact a strike, if you will. And the idea is that you want to get all these kids that are indentured in this way to be able to communicate with each other, form a lobby, and then force change. Is that a summary of your strategy?
Yes, exactly, Ian. The crisis can be fixed with two government reforms. One is to make all interest on student loans nonprofit. That would be the equivalent to the Fed's discount rate, the rate that banks have to pay to borrow money from the Federal Reserve. It's currently 0.75%. So I'm arguing that that rate should be applied to all student loans retroactively. The second reform that's needed is to make payments income-based. That is, take a percentage of the student's monthly income after essentials are paid for, like food and housing, and have that percentage of the remaining money be the money due for the monthly payment. That's called income-based repayment. Now, the government's never going to institute these two reforms because the banks have too much power. So the borrowers have to accumulate enough power to neutralize the banks and force the government to make the changes necessary. How do you get that power? I think you can get it through an internet site that would ask people to make a pledge to stop making their payments when 5 million other people make the same pledge. That means that over the course of a year or two, the number of people making this pledge would gradually increase. The threat of 5 million people withholding payments simultaneously might be enough to actually force change on government prior to them actually having to stop making their payments. If, on the other hand, it doesn't, and 5 million people stop making payments on the same day, the government and the banks will not be able to punish them because they'll be overwhelmed. They don't have the resources to deal with 5 million people simultaneously. So the notion here is a strike, but it's the kind of strike where you say, I'll strike if he strikes. You don't just stop making payments. You create political power by accumulating lots of people all committed to making the same act on the same day, and then you use that power to negotiate a settlement. I think that's a practical solution. I think people who are holding student debt are angry enough to do something like this. I think it takes a little leadership to jumpstart it, and I'm trying to work with people around the country to provide that leadership.
Well, ironically, of course, the president's close friend, Arne Duncan, is supposed to provide leadership. He's the Secretary of Education. The Education Department is not only a part of the problem, they're also a part of this kind of mafia-like collection that goes on to collect these debts. It's so bad that the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has castigated the Department of Education for their strong-arm tactics in screwing the last dime out of these indentured students.
Well, there are so many abuses in this system that we could talk about. The banks now will not provide loans to students unless those loans are co-signed by a family member or somebody else. so that if the student defaults on the loan, the family member then becomes fully responsible for paying it off. That's left a lot of parents in the lurch, and many of them have lost their homes because they're unable to pay off the student loans. Even worse, a lot of parents are still paying off their own student loans. So when their kids come to them and ask them to co-sign a student loan, they can't do it because they haven't finished paying off their own loans. So the student then goes, in some cases, to a grandparent. And the grandparent, wanting to help his or her grandchild, says, oh, sure, I'll co-sign for you, without fully appreciating the consequences. If the student then defaults on that loan after graduation because he or she can't find a job, the grandparent becomes liable to repay the loan. And right now, actually right not right now, a year ago, the number's growing, a year ago there were 119,000 Social Security recipients in America whose benefits were being garnished to pay off student loans. There are people who are on disability, whose disability is garnished to pay off student loans. There are some outrageous injustices going on, and you mentioned Arne Duncan. He is presiding over a Department of Education that has now gone into the student loan business itself, and the Congressional Budget Office in August of 2013 did a 10-year projection on what the profits would be to the Department of Education over the following 10 years, from 2013 to 2023. They estimated that $184 billion would be realized by the Department of Education in profit on student loans. Now, that profit is the equivalent of a federal tax on working and middle-class student families who are required to take out these loans in order to go to college. It is outrageous that our government is doing something like that with one hand while with the other, or on one side of its mouth, while with the other side it's talking about wanting to help students who are in a jam as a result of student loans.
Well, you made the point earlier, Bill Zimmerman, that essentially what's happened is that the education, the burden and obligation of education has shifted from the state back to the student, and you've come up with this way to organize students in a kind of civil disobedience or a protest movement via the internet to, once they reach a critical mass of 5 million, to have the lobbying power to force these very reasonable changes, which is, you know, borrowing money at the same rate that banks borrow from the Fed. And I'm just astounded at the lack of outrage. I mean, maybe it's going to take this bubble to burst like it did in 2008. But the problem is, my understanding is that if we have another Wall Street crisis, and if the second one is caused by the student loan debt burden, the government can't bail them out anymore. They cost us $12 trillion last time. There's nothing left in the kitty, is there?
Well, I don't have a good look at the kitty, but I feel the same way you do. I think we have to deal with this crisis before it leads to the kind of meltdown that occurred in 2008. And that if we don't, we're like the frog sitting in the pot of slowly boiling water. We don't understand what's really happening around us and what the potential threat is. This is something that's impacting the lives of millions of Americans who are suffering needlessly, but it's also something that can bring down the economy in a way that would affect all Americans. So while the banks have enormous influence over the government, I think we've got to create some kind of political force to back them away and force the government to defend the public interest, because it's in jeopardy here.
Well, but, you know, unfortunately, the entire education debate, they're talking about the wrong stuff. you know, the arguments are, you know, between the sort of meddling, ego-driven billionaires who want to have charter schools and teachers' unions defending bad teachers. And that seems to be the sort of dynamic that's going on here, when there's a much, much broader issue that we've been just talking about here. Why isn't that the priority, just to both rescue our students and rescue our economy and revive our economy, because a whole generation that's indentured is not going to be able to contribute to the economy?
I think that debate is coming, Ian. I think that the problems with education, not just higher education, but all of education, are becoming evident to more and more people in the United States. And we've got to change our overall approach. And in particular, with regard to higher education, we need to apply the same logic that was once applied to primary and secondary education. The government has to provide this service in order to create a healthy democracy and a healthy economy. We need to have an informed and capable citizenry. So we once made the judgment that that requires of government the funding of primary and secondary education. That calculation was made 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, and it was correct. We now have to make the calculation that higher education is also part of that. Students today need higher education to survive and flourish in this economy, and we need educated citizens in order to run a democracy that's more efficient and capable than the one that we have. So we have to address the problem of adequately educating all of our citizens at all levels, including higher education. That has to be a government responsibility. So that then raises the question, how do you pay for it? How does government get the funds to do that? And the answer is to create a tax structure that deals not just with these problems, but with all the economic problems we have. We have underfunded infrastructure. We have underfunded public services. We have an underfunded healthcare system. And all of those problems get back to the need to create a more equitable tax structure that captures the money necessary for government to provide citizens with the services they need. We once had an income tax structure that took 90% of the marginal income over $200,000. That was back during World War II, when $200,000 was the equivalent of $5 or $10 million today. There's no reason why we can't institute a tax structure like that again, which captures the money that we need to run government. That's the answer, but it's an answer that it's going to take us a long time and a lot of political activism before we can achieve.
Well, Bill Zimmerman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome, Ian. Glad to have been here.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and candidate races that elected Senator Tim Worth, Senator Gary Hart, and Governor Tony Anaya. In 1990, he co-founded the political consulting and advertising firm Zimmerman and Markman Incorporated, and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. And his latest book is The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Land here under.
disappear.